Boker Tov, good morning everybody. Thank you for coming out after the Chagim, the cleanups going on at home. I wish everybody a Choref Bari, a Gesunter Winter, as they used to say back in the old country. And please God, we should have many opportunities over the winter to get together and to learn some Torah. Having said that, I must tell you that although October is pretty clear, November for me is recruiting month, and so there'll be a few weeks when I'm not here, 3 weeks in November and possibly a week or two in December, but there will be excellent alternative options, and therefore even if I'm not here, things will continue in my absence, Be'ezrat Hashem. But for October we're good, and I'll let you know nearer the time when I'm not going to be here. So I'd like to discuss with you over the next 4 weeks, four different topics, which I've never discussed in this forum before, all of which connect in some way with archaeology, the science of archaeology, and the impact and the interface that has with halacha, with hashkafic issues, and we'll see that there are some really, really fascinating questions to come out. Today and next week is really part one and part two of the sort of introduction to how archaeology impacts or doesn't impact on the halachic process, and we'll see more as we get through the shiur what really that means. 3 weeks from now, which is the week of the Yahrzeit of Rachel Imenu, I want to look at the tense and fascinating topic of the place of the burial of Rachel Imenu, and how that's been dealt with by different people. And then 4 weeks from now, a much more complicated but really interesting topic of the Hebrew scripts of Ktav Ivri and Ktav Ashuri, and how we ended up with the scripts we have today, when actually everything from the classical ancient biblical period is in a completely different script. The Gemara has a lot to say about that. There's a whole sugi in Sanhedrin, which actually has bearing on a number of contemporary issues. We'll get to that when we get there. And that will take us through October, and hopefully you'll find this of interest. Archaeology is a science. It's a modern science. It wasn't always a science. In the ancient world, nobody had heard of archaeology, which is a point which we need to come back to, because that's an important point for us as well. But really, it started in the modern sense in the 16th century, after the Renaissance and the Enlightenment, when people became more and more interested once again in classical culture, in Greek and Roman culture. They started digging things up from under the ground and also collecting art. Early archaeology was very strongly connected with art collection and appreciation. And this received a serious boost when they discovered Pompeii. Well, they knew it was there, but they excavated Pompeii and Herculaneum in the mid-18th century. And then Napoleon added very significantly to this, because Napoleon invaded Egypt in the late 1700s, in 1789. And he was very interested in the archaeology. He took a whole think tank of 175 scholars with him, with libraries and tools and measuring equipment, and they really opened up Egypt. Now, one of the reasons that they didn't open up Eretz Yisrael is because, if you remember the history, Napoleon did not succeed in Eretz Yisrael, and the Ottomans fought him back. The Ottomans were much more closed to allowing these kind of things. It took another half century, but Napoleon really unzipped Egypt in a very significant way. In 1822, they discovered the Rosetta Stone. That was after Napoleon, and of course that unlocked the hieroglyphics of the ancient world. Things continued in the 19th century, where they discovered or created, if you like, the system of strata, of assessing the dates for different archaeological finds based on which strata of the earth they found them in. And then in the 20th century, in 1922, they found Tutankhamun. I'm sure there's a more modern way to say it these days, but Tutankhamun's tomb, and then also the royal tombs at Ur, and things have continued to this day. Now archaeology is a very detailed science, and brings in all sorts of other issues: carbon dating, which they can use for organic matter, epigraphy, which is the study of writing, epigraphy, epigraphic writings and inscriptions, numismatics, which is the study of ancient coinage and money, philology, the study of ancient languages and comparative ancient Near Eastern Semitic languages, impacts on all of this. Having said all of that, there are significant limitations to archaeology, which we'll get to, and we'll see how the poskim deal with those. But as a science, it's clearly come on in leaps and bounds. In Eretz Yisrael, things really got going in the mid-1800s. But what's very interesting is, I'm sure this is true everywhere to some degree, but in Eretz Yisrael, archaeology always came with a very significant agenda. People had something to prove or to disprove. I suspect a little bit more than when they're just uncovering the royal tombs at Ur in Iraq. In Eretz Israel, things were a little bit more tense. It really got off to a start in the mid-1800s when the Ottoman Empire allowed in people like Edward Robinson of Robinson's Arch, Charles Warren of Warren's Arch, and their agenda was to gain a deeper familiarity with the biblical narrative and find traces of the narrative in the ground, and they obviously made a good start at that. By the early 20th century, you had Christian scholars like William Albright, who came to Eretz Yisrael with a slightly different agenda. His agenda was to try and disprove the documentary hypothesis. The documentary hypothesis from Wellhausen from the mid to late 19th century obviously was gaining traction. The documentary hypothesis, which posited that actually the biblical narrative was not chronologically correct, and I'm not getting into the whole biblical criticism discussion now, but there were a number of Christian scholars who wanted to try and disprove that, so Albright came to try and prove the accuracy of the biblical narrative. In the mid-20th century, you ended up with a whole wave of Zionist archaeologists, people like Yigael Yadin, who of course was a general, but also a very famous archaeologist, who came to try and show the connection of the Jewish people with Eretz Israel, and that was his agenda, and he did enormous amounts of work in Masada, in the north, etc., in Gamla. Towards the end of the 20th century, you ended up what they called the school of the new school of archaeology, where people began to try and disconnect archaeology from the biblical narrative and say, let's look at the archaeology without any bias, if that were possible at all, and try and see what the actual rocks say and what the actual finds say, without trying to walk around Israel with a Bible in one hand and a shovel in the other. Let's try and disconnect the two. And of course, that itself led to what they call the nihilist school, which was a school of archaeological thinkers, particularly a fellow called Zeev Herzog. Zeev Herzog is a famous archaeologist. He wrote an article in Haaretz in 1999 saying, basically, as far as he was concerned, almost the entire biblical narrative was completely made up. There was no Avot, there was no Yetzias Mitzrayim, Chas Shalom, there was no Kibush Haaretz, there was no David HaMelech, there was no United Kingdom of the North and South. Really, the archaeologists said, well, things maybe start to get going from Omri and Achav onwards, then we can see stuff in the ground. But before that, as far as he was concerned, of course, without any agenda at all, we'll see that soon, that's not the case at all. His assumption was that the biblical narrative before Achav was incorrect. I brought you a reference in the footnotes here. There's a lot of footnotes on today's share. Not so many sources, but lots of footnotes. To the article he wrote, which was translated and published in the Biblical Archaeological Review, and a response by someone called Herschel Shanks, who has written a lot on these perspectives from a much more biblical-rooted analysis. And you'll see what he says to deconstruct Herzog's analysis, which he says even then in 1999 was just incorrect and very biased. And since then there's been, I think, something of a swing back away from some of the extreme anti-biblical positions in archaeology. And there have been a lot of discoveries, which we'll talk about soon, over the last maybe 15 years, which have made people think again about what they were talking about in the late 1990s. I discovered a very interesting fellow called Dr. Jonathan Adler, who, if you're in the field, you may know about him. I didn't really know about him. This is not my field. But he is a youngish, I suppose he's in his early 40s, archaeologist from Chutz-Laaretz background with a very interesting resume. He's now professor of archaeology in Ariel University. And I brought some links. You can go online, download 50 of his articles. Really, really, really interesting stuff. And very much not in the same vein as people were reading and writing in the late 1990s. So let's go over the page. What I really want to talk about today is halacha, because that's my topic. But I would be remiss if we didn't talk about this first issue, which is a hashkafic issue, which is one of the more fraught questions in archaeology, is whether it can be used to challenge or support the biblical narrative, which I already referred to a little bit just now. This is something that there is a lot of material on, and obviously it's much more politically tense what they dig up in Eretz Israel than what they dig up in Iraq or what they dig up in Egypt, because if you think about it, what comes out of the ground in this country can affect many, many different current narratives, the religious secular debate, which is still ongoing in this country, although changing all the time. It can excite religious Zionist pride when you start digging up Ir David and finding seals from Chizkiyahu HaMelech and from Yeshayahu HaNavi. We'll get to that in a minute. People get very excited and inspired by that, and that changes people's voting habits in this country, which changes the nature of the Knesset, etc. And also, of course, on the American evangelical right, they go nuts about this kind of thing, and that changes voting patterns in the States as well. So if you think about it, what they dig out of the ground in Eretz Israel today can change world politics. It can change who the American president is, it can change who the Israeli prime minister is, and therefore people are very invested in this in all sorts of directions, and one can understand why. And of course it links with the political debate as well. The new school of archaeology came alongside the revisionist school of Israeli history, Benny Morris and Tom Segev, who started rethinking the 48 war and the 67 war and deconstructing the Zionist narrative. All of this went on at the same time and therefore swings in different directions depending on which way you go. So the key issues are very straightforward. Well, they're not very straightforward, but there are a few key issues. I would refer you, if you want, in the footnotes, I've brought you references to Rav Amnon Bazak. Rav Amnon Bazak is one of the key rebbeim in Yeshivat Har Etzion. He wrote a book in Hebrew called Ad Hayom Hazeh, which is a very recommended read. It's in Hebrew, and it's not a small book, but it deals with archaeology, it deals with biblical criticism, and it deals with Chet and Drash. If you want a quicker access to Rav Bazak's Torah, you can go on the Gush Etzion website, the VBM, and you'll see the reference here. And 9 of his shiurim in English on this topic are there, and I read through those. They're very, very interesting. And I brought you some references at the bottom. You can get into that. Some of the key issues are things like whether the camel was domesticated when the Torah seems to say that it was. Some of the classic archaeologists said, well, the camel was only domesticated later in the Iron Age, and therefore references to camels with Avraham Avinu and Yitzchak and Yaakov are anachronistic, and therefore they cannot be chronologically correct. Others have come back and said, lo nachon, that's not true. The camel was domesticated way earlier. It was only brought into mass use as a beast of burden later, and therefore it's not at all anachronistic that Avraham Avinu had camels, and indeed that he sent them with Eved Avraham as a sign of prestige. They weren't used as schleppers. They were used, in fact, very clear when Am Yisrael went down to Egypt. They didn't ride, when the Shvatim, they didn't ride camels. What did they ride? They were donkeys, not camels. And therefore, you know, I'm not an archaeologist and I'm not a biblical expert, and therefore you can bat these arguments back and forth. Another key player in this is Rav Yoel ben Nun, and I brought you a reference to one of his key articles on these issues that he wrote about 15 years ago. Another issue is the location of biblical cities. When they dig in certain places and say, oh, we didn't find any evidence of X, and we'll come back to that argument, loy matzinu, we didn't find. And others say, no, you're digging in the wrong place. The location of I is one of the key questions, if you're interested in these kind of things, from Sefer Yoshua, where exactly I is one of the questions that they debate. And also what you might expect to find. Somebody comes along and says, well, we didn't find any evidence of X. Well, apart from the fact of, well, is that evidence, is absence of evidence the evidence of an absence? Or what would you expect to find? What do you think you're going to find in the Midbar? A rock carved on saying Moshe was here? Or what are you looking for? I mean, it's a serious question. What are they looking for in order to say they didn't find what they thought they might find? Some recent developments include, and this is very exciting, I'm sure many of you have been here, in fact, I'm sure the OU have trips there, the discovery in 2007 of Kirbet Kayafa. Kirbet Kayafa was uncovered as they were unearthing Ramat Bet Shemesh, Gimel, Dalad, Hey, Vav, Zayin, Ched, and onwards. And if you're a fan of Ramat Bet Shemesh, then I'm fine with that. If you have mixed feelings about Ramat Bet Shemesh, then one of the great things to come out of it is Kirbet Kayafa. Because they discovered in Kirbet Kayafa a city which they think may be the ancient city of Sha'arim. And one of the exciting things there is they found, dated to the period of David HaMelech, all sorts of things, inscriptions in Hebrew, very, very ancient, olive pits which they've clearly carbon dated to that period, and this seems to be evidence of a Jewish fort, outpost, really very long way from Yerushalayim, which reassesses people's analysis of what was the extent of the kingdom of David HaMelech. Was it just a small chamula in Yerushalayim, or was it indeed a kingdom? This has been a very, very important find, and some of the reaction of the archaeologists has been stunning in different directions. People trying to reinvent and redefine things so as not to have to analyze this in a way which gives credence to the biblical narrative. Also, they found a couple of years ago, in 2015, a 3,000-year-old seal from the period of King David in the Temple Mount Sifting project. Another thing which, if you haven't done, I'm sure you would enjoy a lot. When the Waqf took out hundreds of truckloads of dirt from Har HaBayis, thinking that nobody would notice hundreds of truckloads going out of the old city, and of course they did, and they dumped all the stuff in Nachal Kidron. You can now go and sift through that, and a little Russian kid about 3 years ago found this 3,000-year-old seal in the middle of the sifting project. They also found in 2015 a seal which has the name of Chizkiyahu HaMelech on it. And then recently they, Elat Mazar, revealed that they found a seal called the Isaiah seal. I brought you here on the bottom of the page a picture of the Isaiah seal. They got very excited by this because they found it a couple of meters away from the seal of Chizkiyahu HaMelech in Ir David. Of course, the two of them were close and related. But the Yeshayahu seal is very interesting because it says on the middle, it has two lines of writing in Ksav Ivri, which we'll come back to in a couple of weeks. It says, Le Yeshayah, and then probably there's an U missing at the end. But the most interesting bottom line is Nun Vet Aleph, which is Nabi, Navi, etc. And there's a whole debate. Did this just belong to some guy called Yeshayahu Navi, and that was his last name? Or was it Yeshayahu HaNavi? It doesn't say a hey. Very interesting things. But again, what comes out of the ground can change the debate on these issues from dark to light in minutes. And therefore, I think it's important, we'll come back to this at the end, not to get too invested in the concerns raised by this, because as I say, it's more complicated than people think. One of the things that Rav Amnon Bezak, will just finish with these three ideas for this part of it, he says you have to try and strip away the agendas. Everybody has agendas, okay? But even the people who say that they're intellectually honest and impartial also have agendas, and you have to strip that away. Rabbi Zach says many of the archaeologists are not reading the text accurately. They're reading what they think it says or what they like it to say. For example, one of the challenges made by the archaeologists against the narrative in Bereshit is that Beersheba as a city was not established until much later. So how can they be talking about the city of Beersheba in Sefer Bereshit? It's obviously not correct. Comes along Rabbi Zach and says, it doesn't say anywhere in Bereshit that Beersheba was a city in Bereshit. You're not reading the text properly. He says it was a makom. It was a place. It was not a major city. So don't read what you think you'd like to be there. Read what's actually there. And of course, that's why the Gush School of Biblical Analysis is critical here, because it's actually reading the text closely. And also it's important, and this is a much bigger issue, as to know how to read Tanakh, to know when it's not meant to be historically accurate. Because pshat is not necessarily, quote-unquote, what happened. It's more complicated than that. And there are parts of the text which are not meant to be historical. And that also needs a nuanced eye. And everyone starts to feel a bit uncomfortable then and say, well, what are you telling me? Are you telling me not everything is taken literally? The answer is, of course not everything is taken literally. If you take everything in the Chumash literally, you're for sure a heretic. Because God has a hand, and God has legs, and God has a long arm, etc., etc. Knowing how to read the parts literally and historically, which are meant to be, and which are parts which are not meant to be, is itself critical. And therefore, usually when people get upset with the clashes, they're reading both sides, both the science and the Torah, without enough subtlety. Enough of that for now. You can read more about that later. Let's get into the main issue that I want to discuss, which is the halachic implications. When we dig, yes, sir. Of course it was. Not just was accused, it was clearly guilty as charged. The British Museum picks up stuff from all around the world. You just need to go there and you can see the frescoes from the palaces of Sancheirov, etc. Look, your attitude to that may depend on your attitude towards colonialism generally. Some people feel it's a jolly good job that they did that because half of the stuff that they left behind has now been blown to pieces by ISIS and others. So maybe the stuff that survived. But yeah, all sorts of things are all over the place. The stuff of ours in Istanbul. And once you get into all of that, like what really belongs to whom, it opens up Pandora's box and becomes a... Every time they take the Dead Sea Scrolls out of Israel, there's a political game play that these really belong to the Palestinians because they were found in Qumran, etc. Once you start getting into who owns what, it becomes very, very tricky indeed. Let's go on. Halacha. When we dig things out of the ground, is that relevant in trying to decide halachic questions? We have halachic shilas, tzvekas, doubts, questions today. Can we use the archaeological evidence to answer those questions one way or the other? And there are many examples that we'll talk about Yetz Hashem next week. One of them, for example, is the Tcheles and the whole question of Tzitzis. Now, we had a couple of shirim about a year and a half ago on Tcheles, but I want to touch next time on a couple of those issues. Which way up does your mezuzah go, or should it go? Should it be vertical? Should it be horizontal? Should it be a nice Jewish compromise on the side, on the slant? Can we find old houses and see where they put the mezuzahs? Is that helpful? Can we construct mikvahs in accordance with ancient mikvahs that we find constructed in certain ways from the ancient world? If we rediscover that a city had a wall from the time of Yeshua ben Nun, does that mean they have to switch to start reading the Megillah on the 15th of Adar and not the 14th of Adar, etc., etc.? These and many other issues will be discussed next week. But there are four precedents, at least that I'm aware of, in the classic sources of where archaeology may or may not be relevant. Let's have a look here in number one. The first precedent is the tzitzit of the Meitei Midbar, and we'll see soon how we read this source. Look at number one, on top of page 3. Amar Rabba Bar Chana, Zimna Chada, it once happened, this is part of a whole series of stories about Rabba Bar Chana, which we'll talk about how we're going to read those in a minute, but let's at least take it at face value for now. Zimna Chada, it once happened, Havaka Zinam Midbara, we were walking through the desert, V'itlali Bahadan Hahutaya, and there was an Arab guide taking us around the desert. He was one of the Amoraim, obviously, from around 1700 years ago. Amali, he said to me, Ta'achvilach, I'm going to show you something. Every guide has their thing, right? They're going to show you this, they're going to show you that, exclusive. Meitei Midbar, I'm going to show you the dead of the Bnei Yisrael, where they're buried, in the Midbar. Oh, great. Azli, they went. V'chavsinu, and they saw them. Paskechad akarnin d'chilta. So, Rabba Bar Bachana cut off one of the corners of the tzitzit of the Meitei Midbar, okay, the Chadminai of one of them, and if you look in Rashbam for second number two, why did he cut the corner of the tzitzit off? Knaf hatalit lahavi'o litnei chachamim. He wanted to bring it as a evidence, exhibit A, to the rabbis in yeshiva, lilmod mimenu din tzitzit ikebei shamai ikebei tilel. There's a machlokes, bei shamai, bei tilel, should the tzitzit have three strings or should they have four strings? He says, well, why are we arguing? Let's just cut off the corner and bring it out. So that sounds like a great idea. The loy havi, back in the middle of the second line, number one, the loy havi mistagilan, but they found that they couldn't move. They were frozen on the spot. Amali, so the guide said to him, Dil mishakalta midi minayu, did you pick anything up? Did you take anything away in your excavations? Ahadre, put it back. The gemiri, because we know we have a tradition, the Arab guides, demand the shakil midi minayu. If you take anything away from these dead people in the midbar, loy mitzagile, you won't be able to leave. They'll stop you from leaving. Azli vardati, so he says, oh, so I put it back. Hada mitzagilan, and then we could move again, and then we came back. So he came back without his archaeological exhibit. Ki asi lekamei drabonon. When we got back to the yeshiva, and this is when it gets interesting, amruli, this is what the rabbi said to me, he says, chol bar barchana, Sichta. Anyone called Bar Bar Chana is a fool. They're obviously not happy with him. You're a fool. Lemay hilchas avet tachi. What were you trying to prove? Lemeida ikebe shama ikebe hillel. You wanted to try and prove it's the halachas like beis hanel beis hillel. This is why you're foolish, he said. Iboy lach leminbe. You should have just counted. Chutin uleminbe mechoyos. You should have just counted the strings and counted the... Why did you have to cut it off? Did you count them? Oi. I didn't count them. Well then, like, what's wrong with you? Now, what do we do with that source? How do we understand that source? Does this source indicate that archaeological evidence is useful? If we can get it, or is not useful. So Rav Herschel Schechter on Nefesh HaRav understands this is a source that, yes, archaeological evidence in principle would be useful. If they could have got the stuff to the Beit Midrash, they could have understood it. If they would have looked, if they would have taken sketches, I don't know what he could have done in the Midbar then, they could have used that evidence. The Rabbanan are telling him, you're foolish. Why? Because you had other ways of getting it and you didn't get it. Others disagree. Rav Chaim Kanievsky and Rav Shlomo Aviner, and I brought you the sources where they say this, say absolutely not. This source proves that you're not allowed to use archaeology. And it's not relevant in halacha. Look at Rav Chaim Kanievsky number 3. Umashe be'emet manu mimenu min ha-shamayim, that he was prevented by heaven, lekachat misham hakerim, from taking the corner of the tzitzis, lebarer halacha, in order to clarify the halacha, v'gam sivivu min ha-shamayim, and also min ha-shamayim, they caused him, shelo yale bedato limnot achutim, he didn't even think to count the strings, shelechayim is a davar poshet, which is an obvious thing to do. He says, the only way I can explain, says Rav Chaim Kanievsky, that he forgot to count, is that there was some, it'd been a shamayim, they took it out of his head, because otherwise, how could he possibly have not done that? Nira mizeh, it seems clear from here, says Rav Chaim, she'ein rotzen HaKadosh Baruch Hu levarer halacha al pi derech. God doesn't want us to use archaeology to work out halacha. But very much ikim, with ancient things, rak al yidei ha-Torah atzma, tzarich levarer halacha. Halacha works based on halachic logic, halachic systems, halachic precedents. You can't dig rocks out of the ground or take clothes from ancient burial sites and try and use them to prove halacha. And we'll see next week that Rav Chaim Kanievsky is not alone in this position. The Chazon Ish clearly takes this position, as does Rav Kook in the early days of archaeology in Eretz Yisrael, and we'll see what Rav Kook's position is. It's a bit more nuanced. But Rav Chaim Kanievsky says, no, this proves you can't use archaeology. A second question, which is perhaps more fundamental, is what does this source prove at all? What do you even do with this source? This is clearly midrashic, highly midrashic. The Rabbi Bar Bar Chana stories, some of them are extremely strange, very weird things going on in those Gemaras. How do I even read this? Maybe this is not meant to be used as any kind of halachic source. Forget about whether you're pro or anti. Maybe this is a purely midrashic source, which you cannot use la halacha at all. But it does raise the interesting question as to whether halacha is a reality based in metziyut, based in the real physical world on some level, or whether it's a construct, which is a much deeper question which we need to look at next week, a bit more philosophical. What is halacha? Is it something which exists in an abstract, detached realm, and really the facts on the ground don't actually matter as much, because it's its own system of thought? Or is it ultimately rooted, and next week we're going to talk about the question of manuscripts. What if I find a manuscript that shows me that a text that I'm using today is not correct? What if we could dig up Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer Torah? We found it somewhere. What would we do? Would we take our current Sifrei Torah and compare them and correct our Sifrei Torah and say, well, I mean, how can you argue with Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer Torah? Or would we say, Moshe Rabbeinu's Sefer Torah is possible? Because he doesn't read like a Sefer Torah halachically has to read. Says the Shulchan Aruch how a Sefer Torah has to read. And Moshe Rabbeinu's Torah is not according to the Shulchan Aruch, therefore you can't use it. And we'll see next week there's a machlokes between different thinkers today as to what we would indeed do with Moshe Rabbeinu. Either we'd dance around the bimah with it, or we'd put a gartle around it and stick it in the back. Yes. Right. Correct. We'll talk about that next week. We'll talk about that. What if some demented scribe flooded the world with fossil Sifrei Torah that became the vast majority of the text? Would that make it the correct rendition? We'll talk about that next week. A secondary, or maybe tertiary, I can't remember where we're up to question before we go on to the next source, is how does this work? Rav Chaim Kanievsky says, Min ha-shamayim, they stop this from happening. Is that right? What happened to Loi v'shamayim hi? Don't we say that God does not intervene in the halakhic process, or even if God does, we don't listen? The famous Gemara of the Tanur, Shalachnoi, in Bav Metzir, there in Nun Zayin, around there, where the voice comes out and says, you know, listen to Rabbi Eliezer, the halakha's like him in all things, and Rabbi Shua says, Loi v'shamayim hi? Do we even accept this idea? Maybe the answer is, well, on specific areas of Psak, no, we don't. But on the general hashgacha of how the world has moved, maybe we do. Meaning, if you think about it, there's an enormous hashkocha in what texts we have and what texts we don't have. Of the 24 wagon loads of Talmuds and Meforshim burnt in Paris in the Middle Ages, think how many Bali Atosvas were lost forever. And think what impact they may have had on the halakhic process. We can't second guess that. There's obviously a hashgacha. Think of all the people who, you know, Nebuch were lost in the Holocaust, and the thoughts and the Torah and the different ideas that might have had in the world today. There is a hashgacha as to how the halakhic system goes, even if individual piskei halacha may not be able to be decided al pi nevuah. And even then it's not so clear, because don't forget there's a shalit and tshuvas min hashamayim. Yeah, Rav Yaakov of Marei, one of the Balei HaTosfos, went into a trance and asked in a dream a number of questions to the heavenly host, got answers, and then wrote down in a sefer all the things that they told him. And the question is, how does that work? Is that legitimate? Is there something strange about that? Can we use Shalit and Shuvah's Min HaShamayim? I remember once when I was in yeshiva many years ago, one of my friends was leafing through Shalit and Shuvah's Min HaShamayim and learning it, and one of the rabbeim in the yeshiva, who was a more rationalist type, came up to him and said, put that down! We don't paskin anything from Shalit and Shuvah's Min HaShamayim. That's not the way we paskin halach. He got quite upset about the whole thing. Other people are not so sure, and the Mishnah Berurah even brings that. What's even more interesting is the kind of questions he asked. Meaning, if you really did go into a trance and felt that you had a few minutes of direct access to the heavenly hosts, what questions would you ask? Because the questions he asked actually are very interesting, not ones I would have thought of. Like, do women make a brocha when they shake the lulav? To which he received the answer, yes, by the way, which is an interesting for the Sfaradim. Anyway, that's not for now. So the tzitzit of the Meisei Midbar is one potential source. Do we or don't we take archaeology as halakhically relevant? Some say this proves that we do. Some says this proves that we don't. Next, Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam Tfilin. So I'm sure everybody is aware that there are at least two, actually there are far more than two, opinions as to how the Tfilin work in terms of the order of the parashas. Looking at number four, this is a brief quote from Shulchan Aruch. Seydi HaChanatan. Hanachatan, sorry, Bebatim. This is how you put the parshas in the batim. I'm sure everyone's aware that the shel yad has four different batim, and the shel rosh is one. This is how it works. L'Rashi v'harambam. For Rashi and the Rambam, this is the order. Kadesh, yeah, mismol hamaniach b'bayt achitzon. Kadesh l'imchol b'chor goes in the far left on the basis of the person who's wearing the tefillin. So if the person was wearing the tefillin, the leftmost bias. On the hand, whatever is, or in the parsha written in the head, is kadesh. The acharav kiviyacha, which comes immediately afterwards, the bayit sheni, ushma the bayit hashlishi, and then shma, which is in devarim, is in the third little box. The hayayim shmoa the bayit revi, and the hayayim shmoa is in the fourth box. Shehu bayit achitzon, you know, which is the far right. Fine. And therefore, what do we have there? We have a pure chronological order as to how they appear in chumash. Kadesh, bayit kiviyacha. Shema and Vaya im Shemoa. Fine. So that's Rashi. Ul Rabbeinu Tam, the Baita Shlishi Vahaya im Shemoa, the Baita Revi Shehu Achitzon Shema. Rabbeinu Tam inverts 3 and 4. So basically, according to Rashi, he goes 1, 2, 3, 4 in chronological order in Chumash. And according to Rabbeinu Tam, he goes 1, 2, 4, 3. That's the Machlokas Mashin Rabbeinu Tam. The Minag Ha'olam Kurashi Varambam. The Minag is to wear Rashi Tzvilin. I don't know why they get in called Rashi Tfilin, not Rambam Tfilin, because Rashi and the Rambam both agree on this, but I think it's because Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, the grandfather, grandson, therefore they get the, you know, when people have the printed, it says Rashi, I've never seen anyone says Rambam, but it's his Shita as well. However, Rabbeinu Tam still makes a comeback in Bet at the bottom here, Yorei Shamayim, Yotze Yidei Shnehem, a Yorei Shamayim has to be Yotze, both opinions. The Yaseh Shtei Zugos Tfilin has to get two pairs of Tfilin, the Yaniach Shnehem, and has to wear them both. And I'm sure people in Eretz Israel have seen that there are people in Eretz Israel who wear both sets at the same time. Very small Tfilin, and one of them is hidden under a big kippah on the hand as well. But if you're a Chabadnik and you have two sets of Tfilin, so Chabad Tfilin are usually about this big each, so unless you had a head like Og Melech HaBoshan, you wouldn't be able to wear both, so you wear them one after the other. In fact, the previous Rebbe of Lubavitch actually had four sets of tefillin, and he wore four different shitas in tefillin to make sure he was wearing the right tefillin, and this, I think, is well known. Many people wear Rabbeinu Tam tefillin as well. By the way, many people do not Rav Moshe Feinstein has a very interesting correspondence with the Lubavitcher Rebbe, where the Lubavitcher Rebbe says, do you put on Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin? And Rav Moshe Feinstein says, no, I wear Rashi's tefillin, it's fine. So he writes back, come on, yeah, how can you not wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin? So he writes back, it's expensive. And the Lubavitcher Rebbe writes back, I'll pay for them. I'll send you a set of... Anyway, and it's like he's trying to get out of it, whatever. So most people do not wear Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, but many, many people do. The question is, why don't we just dig up some old tefillin and check? We found so many pairs of tefillin. We found tefillin in Qumran, in the Dead Sea Scrolls. With the Dead Sea Scrolls, we found tefillin in other places, and we're not there. We didn't just reach that now. Look at page 4, please. Number 5, the Piskei Tosfos, which is written by the Rosh, already in the 1300s, 1200s, 13th century. He writes the following: the Nehar Dor ubi Yerushalayim, in Babel and in Yerushalayim, matzu bet zugim. They found two sets of tefillin, echad to Rashi, the echad to Rabbeinu Tam. Meaning, this didn't start with Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam. There were people 1,000 years before Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, and some of them were wearing Rashi's tefillin, and some of them were wearing Rabbeinu Tam's tefillin, although obviously they didn't call them that. In fact, Rav Gorin takes the view that this is an ancient machlokes between Babel and Eretz Yisrael. That in Babel they followed one shita, and in Eretz Yisrael they followed a different shita. With the Dead Sea Scrolls, we actually found many different types of tefillin. Some of them were one way, some of them were a different way. Some of them were neither shita of Rashi and Rabbeinu Tam, but other shitas. Dr. Ardley, who I mentioned at the beginning, has an excellent piece online where he gives pictures of all the different tefillin found in Qumran. And by the way, it's amazing to see these minute, tiny little tefillin that really look exactly like modern-day tefillin in terms of their construction, that are 2,100 years old and even more. In fact, some of them had extra parshas in. Remember we had a shir about the Ten Commandments? And I said that there was a discussion in the Gemara as to whether you should include the Ten Commandments in the parshas of the tefillin. Well, in the Qumran tefillin, they actually found some tefillin with the Ten Commandments in them. Which raises another question, which is, when we find stuff which is buried in the ground, how do we know who wrote it? How do we know whether it was written by, quote-unquote, orthodox people, or, quote-unquote, sectarian people? How do we know that it wasn't written and decided it was potful? And that's why they put it in the ground, which we'll see in a minute, is one possibility. You dug up a pair of tefillin from the ground, shkayach, maybe they were put there because no one wanted to use them. And we'll see that argument used in a minute. Look at the smag. Look at number 6. The smag, one of the Balei Tosfos sources, Mikol Makom Nagu Be'eretz Ad Edom, in Europe, he says, Ube'eretz Yishmael, and in the Arab lands, Kedivri Rabbeinu Shlomo, we go like Rashi, or Kedivri Rabbeinu Moshe, and like the Rambam, the same Shita, we follow Rashi's tefillin. The Gam Shalchu Ksav me Eretz Yisrael, and says the Smag, again this is a medieval source, we received a letter from Eretz Yisrael. Shenafla Bima Sha'al Keva Yechezkel. One of the bimots, one of the big slabs on Keva Yechezkel. I doubt anybody here in this room has ever been to Keva Yechezkel. Anyone been to Keva Yechezkel? It's in Iraq. If you want to make an OU trip, maybe, that nobody's done before, and no one will ever do again, probably, okay? Maybe a trip to Iraq to see Keva Yechezkel. If you go online, you'll see this was the Iraqi Jews, it was a very well-known site, Keva Yechezkel, in Iraq. One of the slabs fell down, says the smag. Umatsu sham tefillin yishanim. They found very ancient tefillin. Ma'oi, very, very ancient tefillin. Kaseid Rabbeinu Moshe, like Rambam Barashi. So he says, and again, he feels that that's worth citing, that they found ancient tefillin. This again seems to be a source that says that archaeology has an impact on halacha, because he wants to prove, like Rashi, from these tefillin. Comes along the Drisha and makes the point that I made just now. The Drisha is a commentary on the Torah. For Shamati Mishem Mori, I heard from my teacher, who is either the Marashal or the Ramah, I'm not going to prove anything against Rabbeinu Tam from the fact that they found Rashi tefillin in Iraq from ancient Rashi, ancient tefillin of Kedivrei Rashi. Sha'adarabba, on the contrary, he says, Rabbeinu Tam would answer you, Shepsulim hayu. They were potful tefillin, that's why they were buried. Because they wrote them the wrong way round, and that's why they put them in a kever. What do you do with all your apostles, Sifrei Torah, and tefillin? You bury them with a tzaddik. If you find me tefillin in the kever of Yechezkel, that's proof that they're not good tefillin. Not that they are good tefillin. Which is an interesting claim, because if that's the case, why would they bury them? Why couldn't they just switch the parshas around? Unless it's a shel rosh and you can't do that. So there are questions on these. So anyway, that's the second issue. Are we going to use a tefillin that we find in the ancient world to prove archaeology one way or the other? That's discussed in classic sources. The third, and in my opinion, the most fascinating of all of them, is the Ramban's Chetzi Shekel. So a number of mitzvahs, in particular Pidyon HaBen, depend on the weight of the shekel. How heavy is a shekel? In fact, all of the shiurim, I once went to a museum, a fascinating place, called, I've just forgotten the name, the Living Judaism Museum, so like Brooklyn. I think the Living Judaism Museum. It's a fellow called Deutsch, a brilliant, brilliant man, a rabbi called Rav Deutsch, and he's taken three houses in Brooklyn, and he's knocked them together, and he's created, I assume it's still there, created a museum. You will never believe what's in the middle of Brooklyn. I mean, there's a lot of things in the middle of Brooklyn that you would believe, but he has got stuff there that you would never, ever believe. He's got, he does salvages for shipwrecks. He raises money to raise shipwrecks from international waters. He then sells off all the stuff that he's not interested in to Greek antiquity collectors and Roman, etc., to fund the salvage. And he keeps the Jewish stuff. He's got original stuff there, many coins from the time of the Beis HaMikdash. He's got the oldest copy of the Ten Commandments ever in the world that's been found. He was sued by the Israel Museum because they said it belonged to them. And he won. And he's got it there. He's got the parochas from the Malbin. He's got amazing, amazing things. I hope he's got insurance. But although if you sell that stuff, I know, what would you do with it? You wouldn't be able to sell it anywhere in Brooklyn, that's for sure. Shekel of the Ramban that we'll see in a minute is one of the most fascinating questions. Number 8. The Kaf of Rashi. Ramban writes in his Perush al HaTorah, the Rashi, he quotes Rashi, Sheha Shekel, how heavy is a shekel? Mishkalo Arba Zehuvin. 4 gold coins. Shuhu chatzi okia. Now okia, they translate okia as an ounce. I'm probably not pronouncing it right, and it may have been miswritten from the Rashi, original French. It's a half an ounce, le mishkal hayashar shel kolonia, of Cologne. So Rashi gives the measurement of a shekel based on German measurements from Cologne in the Middle Ages. Aval shir harav bezehuvim hamintayim bedoro. But the Rashi, says the Ramban, is basing his measurements on coins in our generation, of Gamba Doreinu, in his and ours. The Henke Mishwa Chetzi Ha'aki Ha'zeizkir, and this is the half ounce that he found, the Einenu Kain. And it's not right, says the Ramban. Rashi's got it wrong. Ki Malche Ha'goyim Pachatu Ha'zuhavim. Because the non-Jews have changed the coinage. And actually, the Ramban paskins like the Rif. And the Rif says that the actual weight of a shekel is a sixth larger than the Rashi's sack, and he says Rashi's got it wrong. And in his commentary on the Torah, Ramban paskins like the Rif. Now, when the Ramban made Aliyah at the end of his life, involuntarily, because as you know, the disputation, he was forced to leave Spain, he came to Eretz Israel, and he wrote back to the rabbis of Catalonia that now he's reached Eretz Israel, there are a couple of things that he's changed his mind on. He wrote his Perush on the Chumash while he lived in Spain. But once he reached Eretz Israel, he wrote some glosses on the Chumash. There are actually Sforim coming out. It's a fellow called Yosef Oren, Rav Yosef Oren, who wrote a Tosefot HaRamban, which is a whole sefer just based on these additions that the Ramban put in there. And two of the most famous things that he changed his mind in is this, and the location of Kever Rachel, which we'll get to, because he writes that I used to think that Kever Rachel was somewhere to the north of Yerushalayim, which made most sense to me based on the text. And now I find I'm in Eretz Israel, everyone's going to a place near Bethlehem. So obviously I'm wrong, and that must be where Kever Rachel is. We'll get to that when we get there. The other thing he said is this. Look at number 9. Baruchani Hashem, God has blessed me. He wrote this later. Ad Kor up until now is based on a potik, but he maybe also play on words of Akor, because he lived in Akor. He made Aliyah to Akor, which was the place to live. Now Akor is not such a popular destination with Olim, but then it was the place to be seen. Shizachiti ubati la'ako. I live in Akko. Umatati sham beit zikne haaretz. Zikne haaretz. I found in the hands of the old people who live here, the ancients, the sages here, matbea kesef mufutach betuche chotem, which is clearly marked with engravings. Mitzido echad, on one side of the coin, ke'ein makel shaked, is some kind of an almond branch. Umitzido asheni, and on the second side, ke'ein siluchit, is some kind of a goblet. And if you look at the coin on the bottom of the cage there, you'll see that that's the coin. That's basically the coin that he found. I'm not sure it's an almond branch. It looks more like a pomegranate. It could be pomegranates. But you see, that's basically the coin that he found. Ubeshnev Tadim Saviv Katav Mufutach Ber Hesev, and there were clear writing on the coins. But he couldn't read it. Why could he not read it? Because he was in Ktav Ivri, and he couldn't read Ktav Ivri. The Hirawa Ktav Lekutim, Vakarumiyad, and he showed it to the Samaritans, non-Jewish people that lived and live still in the north. More about the Samaritans when we talk about Ktav Ivri, and they read it immediately. Kihu Ktav Ivri, because this is Ktav Ivri, Asher Nish'a Lekutim, because it says in the Gemara there that only the Samaritans really have Ktav Ivri, and indeed if you go to the little village of Shomron, it's called Shomronim, down by Har HaBracha. If you take a trip up to visit Rav Eliezer Melamed and Yeshivat Har HaBracha, you can take a little day trip to Shomronim, which is very easy to get to. It's clearly accessible. And you'll see all the Samaritans living there there's the good Samaritans and the bad Samaritans. There's a whole lot there, okay? And there's written in Ksav Ivri on the doors, etc. I actually went to visit, I'll tell you about a trip I made on Sukkot a few years ago to visit the Samaritans. It was a very interesting trip. Kamashe Muskaba Sanhedrin, as we've seen Sanhedrin. Bakaru min atzare echad shekel hashkalim. On one side, they read it said shekel hashkalim. Umin atzare sheni Yerushalayim hakadosha. Now, actually, I'm not getting into all of the details, but it doesn't actually say shekel hashkalim. It says shekel Yisrael. And there's a whole discussion about how the Samaritans misread and read it as Shekel Ashkalim and not Shekel Yisrael. And there are discussions as to why they might have made that mistake, but the fact that they made a mistake, and actually it's picked up by Rav Azariah de Rossi later on in Meir Einayim, that he got it wrong, and the Samaritans got it wrong, so that proves to you that sometimes the evidence that you're looking for is not always going to be clear in terms of the expert evidence. But anyway, he said it said that. So I weighed it. V'shulchanot. And with on the coin exchanges there, umishkala asara kesiv astralins, and he weighted a certain number of 10 silver coins. The hein chatzio kish is kiru Rabbein Shlomo, and that turns out to be exactly what Rashi said it should weigh. Rashi's coinage measure was what I found. He says the hein in nistaya divrei Rabbein Shlomo siyu gadol, and I've changed my mind. Or has he changed his mind? That's the question. He says what I've certainly found is a big proof in favor of Rashi. Now, there are some that say, well, the Ramban didn't change his psak. And actually, fascinatingly, the Shulchan Aruch still paskens like the Rif, and not like Rashi, even though the Ramban found the coins. He's not that impressed by that find. But there are others that say, no, if you go over to page 5, please, the Yaivet, number 10, says, Hinei besoif, hoida Ramban shadinim Rashi bazeh. In the end, the Ramban had no choice, he says, but to accept that the din is with Rashi. Because how can you deny it? He had it in his hand. He saw it with his eyes. You can't deny the archaeology. If there's a weight to something called a shekel, and you find a shekel, then that's what it weighs. You could maybe ask the same question. The debate as to how big is a tefach, and how big is an amma. And we're dealing with, you know, Rav Chaim Noy says this, and the Chazon Ish says that. Well, why don't you just go down to Yerushalayim and measure the gate that we found from the second base of Mikdash? And you can see how big an armor was. Maybe it's not so straightforward. Who says that Herod built on the right? Who said that they were every shita according to that, etc.? The Abarbanel is not happy. The Abarbanel says, how does he know that the coins didn't lose some weight over the years? Something got rubbed off them. How does he know they were the original weight? The truth is the archaeologists can tell that these days, whether they have or have not lost material. The Tashbetz is very unhappy that he chooses non-Jewish Samaritans to give evidence as to halacha. Where do we start getting into that? And that raises the very interesting question is, what is the weight of the evidence of a non-Jewish archaeologist or a non-religious Jewish archaeologist? And that raises the issue of Mesiach Lefitumo, which is a whole halachic discussion, which we'll touch on next week, which is, can I trust what people who are non-halachic people say if they're just saying it innocently? I give my pot of chicken soup into which a little bit of milk has fallen, and I give it to someone to taste. What do you think this tastes like? Milky or not milky, etc.? How do I gauge the weight of that evidence? How do I know they're not just saying what I want them to say, or saying the opposite, that's because they're anti-Semitic? I don't know. Whatever, all sorts of people have all sorts of agendas. But interestingly, even though the Rambam found these coins, there doesn't seem to be a massively enthusiastic response. And as I said, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't pass it in that way anyway. More about non-religious archaeologists next week. The fourth case, which is the final case, is the writing on the tzitz. So let's have a look at this. Number 11. Says the Pasuk in Shemot, Va'asita tzitz zahav tahor. The Pasuk says you have to make a tzitz, a plate for the Kohen Gadol's head, which is pure gold, ufitachta alav p'tuche chotam, and you have to write very clearly, Kodesh la'Hashem. Kodesh la'Hashem. Sanctified to God. So, says the Gemara in Shabbos, number 12, Va'atanya, tzitz kemin tashel zahav, the tzitz is a plate of gold, v'rochev shtei etzvot, and it's two finger breadths wide, umukaf me'ozel la'ozel, and it goes from one ear to the next, it's like a plate, a head plate, that goes around the Kohen Gadol's head, and it's tied at the back with a p'til t'chelet, a little bit of a little thread of t'chelet wool. V'katav alav v'shtei shittin, and it's written with two lines, on two different lines, yud, and a hey lamala, Hashem's name is on the top, to put Hashem's name on the top, the kodesh lamed lamata. So you have to read it from bottom up. Hashem's name is on the top, and kodesh le is at the bottom. It's kodesh le, then on top of that Hashem. That's how it's written. The Amar Rabbi Elazar, but Rabbi Yosef, the son of Rabbi Yosef comes along and says, excuse me, ani ra'intiv, I've seen the tzitz. How has he seen the tzitz? There's no Kohen Gadol by the time of Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yosi, Rabbi Yosi. Ani ra'iti b'ir Romi. I have visited Rome, and I have seen the tzitz, v'kos of Kodesh Lashem b'shtahav. And I saw with my own eyes, it's written on one line, Kodesh Lashem. It's not written on two lines. How did he see the tzitz in Rome? So this raises the constant discussion, is someone hiding our stuff somewhere in the Vatican? I don't know the answer to that question, I'm sorry to say, but I've done a bit of research, and I send you even to a link here by a very interesting article where Professor Lawrence Schiffman was interviewed on this. The consensus seems to be that nobody's hiding anything anywhere, I'm afraid to say. There's even, the Vatican's even addressed this. Someone wrote them a letter recently saying, can we have our stuff back, please? And they wrote, actually, the first time they've ever responded, a very polite response, saying Francis is the current one? Yeah. Right, Pope Francis is very open about these things, and we'd like to address the fact very clearly, we don't have any of your stuff. It's not there. If it was there, we'd give it back. Don't worry about it. But then you can't put this conspiracy theory down. They certainly think that there's a lot of stuff going on underground there. The truth is, Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yossi would have seen it in the Palace of Peace that was put together by Vespasian, meaning when he took all the stuff away, he put it all on display in a Roman palace in the middle of Rome. And people were able to file in like a kind of museum and see the stuff. That we know from the contemporary sources. Subsequently, Rome was sacked multiple times by the Goths and the Visigoths and the Lombards and you name it, who sacked Rome. The Vatican was only set up in the 700s, in the 8th century. So the chances of the Vatican having anything is extremely, extremely low, but I don't know. You have to go to the Vatican and ask them. But one way or the other, he saw this. Oh, so that proves it, right? No, actually, sadly not. The Rambam, Paskins, number 13 as follows. Kate Sadmati Aziz. How do you write the tzitz? Ozit Hashel Zav, you make a plate of gold. Baruch Hashem Esbot, two finger breadths wide. Umaki Be'ozin Le'ozin, just like the Gemara says from ear to ear. V'kosev Alav, Shnei Shittin Kodesh Lashem. Paskins like the Tanakama. Like the original opinion, Kodesh Melamata, Lahashem Melamata. Actually, not quite. He says Kodesh and Lahashem is on the top. Slight difference. The im kasvu b'shita acha, but if you wrote it on one line, kosher. But yeah, it's kosher. I mean, there were lots of tzitzin produced over the years. The way to produce it, ideally, lechatchila, is to produce it on two lines. But if you produce it on one line, okay, it works. Upamim kasvu b'shita achas, because sometimes they wrote it on one line. How does he know? Because he's taken it from the Gemara. Because people saw it on one line. The fact that people saw a tzitz written on one line, says the Rambam, that doesn't prove that's the way to write a tzitz. That proves that some people wrote it that way. But maybe they were the minority. Which raises another interesting question. When I dig something out of the ground, how do I know that's representative of what most of the things were? I have to find that one. That was the one that survived. Maybe that was a very small minority in that example of what was actually made, and the Rambam does take it into account, the archaeology, But he doesn't paskin that that's how to do it, because he's concerned maybe that's not the way that most of them were done. So let's just finish off in the last couple of minutes, just on the last page. I want to just mention a few limitations of archaeology. And I've written down 9, but there are others as well. One of the problems, and we'll see this in the Chazon Ish, and we'll see this in Rav Kook next week, one of the problems with archaeology is most of what's there has not yet been found. Now, you can get different percentages from different people. Rav Yoel ben Nun wants to say that 95% of what's underground has not yet been found. We've found 5%. Maybe it's more, but it's certainly the majority is not yet there. And therefore, any conclusions based on what we have found will have to be tentative. One new find next week could change the way that archaeologists view the whole thing, and therefore making conclusions based on the fact that we haven't found most of it is very difficult. On the other hand, not all conclusions are equal, and sometimes you found so many things, it's like people say about science. Oh, what's the point of learning science, or not, what's the point of this? What's the point of being stressed by the conflict between science and Torah, if there is indeed a conflict, which is not for now? The science will all change anyway. In 100 years' time, no one will even believe the science that they... Well, that's only true to a point. They're not going to decide that the Earth is flat. They're not going to go with the Ptolemaic system that actually the sun goes around the Earth. They're not. They're not going to change certain things. So too, in archaeology, we've dug up hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mikvahs with the same set design. It's extremely unlikely that someone's going to come around and say, actually, they were the minority of mikvahs. The thousands that you haven't discovered were something different. So you can form some conclusions based on archaeology, but not necessarily all the conclusions. Even more important, and this is 2, archaeology often concludes based on what we have not yet found. And that's not valid. Loi matinu, or loi ra'inu, ain't a raya. That's the halachic principle. The fact that we didn't see it, like I said earlier, absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And very often they say, oh, we never found any archaeological remains of whatever it is, therefore it didn't happen. That's an intellectually lightweight argument, which has to be treated with some concern, if you like. Thirdly, many archaeological sites are simply unavailable for excavation because of economy. Some of them are very hard to excavate. Some of them have been built over inhabited. Some of them are just politically hot. You know, wouldn't we love to excavate Har HaBayis and see what can be found there? Well, as I said before, that's not going to happen anytime soon. Maybe they did us a great favor by taking all the dirt out, putting it in the Kidron Valley. We can, in the back way, excavate under Har HaBayis. But we're not getting onto the mountain soon. Many things were not preserved. Food, obviously, is not preserved. Papyrus, skins, wood. Many things that we're seeing are only a small segment. Some things are not in their original form. As I said before, many things were buried specifically, and they're unrepresentative. They were invalid, etc. Also, ancient scrolls and archaeological finds often tell blatant lies. Kings tell stories of victories and battles that never happened. Or they pump up the popularity levels of their regimes by lying shamelessly. We have to know how to interpret, and as I said before, the agendas that people have. Finally, and this is just really a segue into next week, some of the main issues that we need to look at as follows. Even if we're satisfied that what we've dug up from the ground is accurate, what halachic weight does that have? Does it raise a sofek? In which case, maybe the sofek won't help us because we already have a halachic raiv or a chazaka. Meaning, just because I find something that seems to go against the halacha, that doesn't mean the halacha changed. If someone comes up and says, City X was walled at the time of Yoshua ben Nun, maybe I'll accept that, maybe I won't. What are the precedents from other areas where we do consult expert doctors, for example? When the doctor says that Pliny has to eat on Yom Kippur, oh, we listen to the doctor. Does that mean that we listen to everybody that says everything, or is the doctor a special case? How do we view archaeology versus a masora? One of the big debates about Tcheles is that you can't use Tcheles because we don't have a masora. We don't have a tradition of Tcheles. Or we have a tradition that we don't have Tcheles, which is a little bit different, but we'll see next week. How does that work? And as I said before, how do we weigh the views of Jewish or non-Jewish or non-religious Jewish archaeologists? And all of those factors will be looked at next week. But Ezra Hashem, this has given us just the beginning. Next week, as I said, we'll take it in a slightly different direction. We'll look at manuscripts as well. And we'll take it from there. Have a wonderful week. Hope everyone gets back into their routine. And we'll speak soon, please God.